But even just before the actual commission started asking the questions, the banks provided submissions, and they all pretty much knew they were stuffed, because he notes that pretty much all the banks in their submissions noted that they engaged in misconduct and conduct falling short of community standards and expectations in connection with home loans, credit cards, processing errors, car finance, basically our entire business.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. This week we're going to dive headfirst, hopefully no concussions, into the banks. Yes, you'll understand the concussions when we say what we're going to talk about. We're diving into the banks. Late last week, the Banking Royal Commission, headed by, it is Kenneth, isn't it?
Kenneth Hayne.
The redoubtable Kenneth Hayne produced an interim report, and the interim report was a very weighty tome, and the
summation—thousand pages.
Yeah, 1,000 pages, but who's counting? Gareth and I were reporting that Friday. Anyway, never mind. Yes. Anyway, it's the summation of months of inquiry. Now, joining me in the studio, you've probably worked out who's joining me in the studio by that untidy introduction. The wonderful, of course, Greg Jericho, our Guardian Australia colleague, man of charts, facts, graphs and associated enterprises. Welcome, Greg.
Hello.
And also the lovely Gareth Hutchins, who looks after economics for us and has, for his sins, been glued to all or, well, no, not all, but certainly most.
I've missed about a week.
Yes, most of the hearings with this Royal Commission. So given that we've started... given I ended there, let's start there, Gareth. Hmm. Let's assume, because I think it's a safe assumption that the listeners will not have been glued to all of the hearings over recent months. So let's just recap the story to date. What has emerged as a consequence of this inquiry?
Okay, well, the inquiry's been running since March, and we've had 6 rounds of hearings now, and it's covered things like consumer lending to banks and consumers and agricultural entities, superannuation, insurance and financial advice.
Mm-hmm.
The interim report only covered the first 4 rounds of hearings,
mm-hmm.
so we still have a bit to go.
But let's take a step back further. What's obviously, I think anybody connected to the news cycle would just have a take-home impression, right? Mm. Royal Commission, banks bad, right? But what have we heard over the last couple of months? Let's sort of summarise how the big banks have fared. What sort of, you know, what's the broad thrust of it?
The broad thrust of it is that the Commissioner, Hayne, has found that the banks have been putting greed profits before consumers, before their customers. It's been a kind of roll call of the worst things you can imagine happening to your money or your fears coming true.
Mm.
The things you suspect are happening have been happening.
Mm. Such as?
Such as
fees for dead people?
Yeah, you know, if you have a life insurance policy and you've unfortunately died, then before that policy is paid out to your family members, fees are still being deducted from it. They've also been charging fees without providing you any services.
Nice.
All these types of things. They've been exploiting the fact that there is a large level of not just financial illiteracy, but most of us just don't quite understand a lot of the fees and charges that are attached to these things.
Well, I definitely don't.
So that I don't either. And they're operating in the dark with our money, taking things from us which belong to us, which we don't know about. This has all been exposed week after week, month after month.
And has anyone fared any better than anybody else? Or, I mean, I know that's a tough judgment to make, but is any financial institution thus far that's been interrogated sort of come out any better than any other or any worse than any other? It's probably a more direct way of asking the question.
The two ways you can think about it. If you want to say who's come out worse, you'd have to say AMP, massive insurance company. National Australia Bank has also been particularly bad. Now, we heard a lot about Commonwealth Bank over the last few years, but National Australia Bank has been really bad.
Mm-hmm.
When we jump over to looking at who has fared better than you would expect, in the superannuation round, we heard that retail funds, which are for-profit funds owned by the major banks, have been behaving particularly badly, mismanaging your money, whereas the industry funds, which are not-for-profit, often run by unions or with union board members, have been behaving pretty well.
Mm.
So they only got off with a not even really a slap on the wrist in some cases, but the retail guys have been...
Copped it between the eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, that's copping it between the eyes takes us to Greg and the interim report. So that came out last Friday. What did... what's Commissioner Haynes' broad summation of you know, of all of this bad conduct?
Well, as Gareth was saying, it doesn't cover everything that he's looked at yet. We've still got insurance and superannuation to come, and there's a lot of worms in that cesspit that can be found pretty much once the lid has been lifted off.
Oh,
it.
God.
It's
that's quite gross, really.
The three volumes mostly are looking at the operation of banks in terms of credit lending, home loan lending, credit cards, financial advice, especially a bit of agricultural stuff there as well. He actually points out that he wasn't required under the terms of reference of the Royal Commission to produce an interim report, but he basically was like, we've got so much here, it justifies putting something out and almost posing a few questions to get people thinking about what can be done, what should the final recommendations be, because he's pretty much really the entire interim report could just, you know, pretty much be subtitled as, you know, greed is good. That's yeah. pretty much, you know...
Customers who?
Yeah, rather nicely in his executive summary, he says, you know, the questions really are, he's asking why have all these things happened where we've seen all these... Everyone's perception that the banks are screwing us has turned out to be true. Why has this been happening? And he says, too often the answer seems to be greed, the pursuit of short-term profit at the expense of basic standards of honesty. And he goes through detailing, you know, specific examples of banks... but even just before the actual commission started asking the questions, the banks provided submissions, and they all pretty much knew they were stuffed, because he notes that pretty much all the banks in their submissions noted that they engaged in misconduct and conduct falling short of community standards and expectations in connection with home loans, credit cards, processing errors, car finance, basically our entire business.
Across the board.
And it's so he goes through pointing out some of these the issues that have occurred, such as you know, 69,000 Westpac home loan customers being charged more interest than they should for their home loans. NAB admitting to cases of about 16,000 credit defaults that were actually erroneous, that they were wrong and, you know, meant that they were being charged fees and that there were even contraventions of the Privacy Act in terms of this type of thing. And he doesn't quite get to the full list of recommendations and everything, but he's really sort of almost shouting to everyone about how bad it is when he's actually saying new laws won't actually do much. It's a startling thing because he says that the problem isn't really that there's a lack of laws, it's that the banks don't give a stuff about them, really.
Exactly. So let's pick up on that. So the regulators obviously did not come out of this very well at all, ASIC and APRA. The Haynes general conclusion, wasn't it, was that they had either been asleep at the wheel or had engaged in a sort of culture of conciliation at the expense of the consumer. Take us through that a bit, Gareth.
Well... the interim report was a fascinating document because he's basically questioning the intellectual foundations of our era of regulation that we've been existing in the last 20 years. So can I go back to the 1990s
Please.
Very quickly?
No, this is the point. This is the point of this conversation.
We had a financial system inquiry in the mid-90s chaired by a guy called Stan Wallace.
The Wallace
it's
Inquiry.
Called the Wallace Inquiry.
I was even here. Anyway, I won't bore you with that. Go on, Gareth.
He, by the way, went on to become chairman of AMP.
in a strange coincidence.
But that report recommended an overhaul of the regulatory structure as it existed, and it led to the creation of ASIC and APRA the following year. And part of its recommendations were that those two regulators would work in a cooperative way with the banks. It was going to be light on regulation, more conciliatory. It was built on the belief that efficient markets with as little regulation as possible would lead to the best consumer outcomes. But that has, at the same time, it cemented the four pillars policy, which was an oligopoly. And as time went on, the banks learned to become very good oligopolists. And, you know, consumers have suffered.
And it's the thing with the whole efficient market philosophy and hypothesis operates on customers actually having
perfect information.
Yeah, having knowledge of what's going on. And the problem that this report found isn't so much that we as consumers are financially ignorant, which we certainly perhaps are not as knowledgeable as we could be on a lot of things, and that's something even the Productivity Commission has found out about superannuation. But it's that the banks are using that to make the system even more complex and obscure, so that it's not really our fault that we don't know what's going on. That's the purpose of the system. And when you've got that, suddenly there ain't no efficient market hypothesis going on. You've got, as you say, an oligopoly and a very walled one.
Asymmetrical information. The banks have all the power. The banks even choose the amount of risk that they take on when they're taking on customers. The Productivity Commission, in their recent report of the super industry, actually pulled apart this idea that we're all rational actors. It says, no, we're human beings. We're overcome with emotion at times. We're irrational a lot of the time. We're going to have to start designing policies that admit that reality. And this is essentially what Hayne is saying as well.
Well, he is saying that, but he's also, I think, saying implicitly, now you guys pull me up if I'm wrong here, I think he's saying implicitly, though, there's all the factors that we've unpicked there, but it's almost like, as a consequence of all of this, the banks have got too much market power, right? That the banks actually kind of tower over the regulators, and there is this sort of culture, this conciliation culture, which, as you rightly say, Gareth, sort of stems from the Wallace period, right? And stems of 20 years of consensus around how to regulate in a market economy, right? But there's this power imbalance, which is sort of implicit in his analysis, that somehow the regulators either don't speak up as they should or take them to court as they should. And so that's quite a complex thing to deal with, isn't it?
There is an aspect of the big four especially are too big to fail and too big to undermine the confidence to the extent that, you know, having Westpac or NAB or whichever bank going to court over various things, it's almost that sense of, you know, we don't want to rock the boat. Let's keep the banking ship sailing nicely. But the problem is that the banks are aware of this, that this is how they're operating, and Hayne points out that the banks regard regulatory compliance, which is a nice way of saying paying for breaching regulations, as just a cost of business.
Cost of business. Yeah. So, and from that, you know, sort of stems, presumably, I mean, maybe I'm running away with my own analogy here, but it's sort of like, if you regard the costs of regulation as the costs of doing business, there's almost an inbuilt contempt in that relationship, isn't there? Yep. It's not like, you know, the cop pulls you over because you're 20K over the speed limit and you think, oh, God. It's like the cop pulls you over, you get out your checkbook, everybody, you know, sort of sits around, has a cup of coffee and goes home.
They pretty much, he found that, you know, because of this attitude that risks to reputation were ignored because they knew there really weren't any risks, discovery of misconduct was managed by an apology, a promise not to do it again. There would be suggestions of fines, which didn't always actually come to play, that sort of sense of, you know, almost, well, this is your last warning, mm-hmm. you know, and it's until I give you another last warning.
Yeah, exactly.
And it just became a big feedback loop of them knowing that they could get away with these things. I mean, it really resonated a lot with what you saw in America prior to the GFC, and that still continues because it's not like they've tightened anything up, of regulators not really having any power, and the banks knowing that, yeah, they'll all look away or give us a stiff talking to, and then we can go on our merry way again, and it doesn't end up well.
No, well, obviously not. And the reaction of the banks, guys, like, obviously I was there on Friday and did the main news story, so I saw that flood of press releases of mea culpa, we bad, aren't we wicked, yes, tremendous, we
are
wicked, day of shame.
It's just more of the same, though. Like, it's so frustrating watching this. Been reporting on banks, the way they've been behaving for nearly 10 years now. It's such a cycle. And they're using the same words of apology as they have in the past. What's going to change? Mm. The thing that's going to have to change will be a beefed up, angry regulator
that
bursts in the door with its guns blazing.
I mean, there have been a few changes of leadership. A few CEOs have had to fall on their sword.
Yeah,
there has been a slight underperformance of their shares, but not really. You know, it's not like there's anything so far that would suggest that there is going to be a great incentive to change, other than to make it seem like they are changing. You know, I think they'll put, at the moment, their efforts would be mainly into making it seem like they're changing rather than actually changing.
God, this is massively depressing.
It is.
Let's pull ourselves. Shake. Here we go. So obviously this is only the interim report, guys. So we have a final report to come, and that's scheduled for next February if memory serves. So given that Kenneth Hayne has produced this, you know, 1,000-page forensic stock take of terrible conduct and regulators asleep on the job, what's the territory for the final report? Where are we going to go?
Well, we're going to hear obviously about their findings in the superannuation round of hearings and the insurance round as well, because we didn't hear about them in the interim report. But the recommendations will be the fascinating thing, and you know, as hard as it is to predict anything in politics,
no, go
or
for
whatever.
It. Well, you've got some thoughts, which I think you should share with the listeners.
It has to lead to a massive change at ASIC and even APRA. They're going to have to prepare for an overhaul of some kind. Because as I was saying before, like if this report, it marks the moment when the intellectual foundations of the last 20 years has been completely undermined.
Mm.
And so we will continue to point back to his analysis here, saying we've got to move on from this point. Now, that means that ASIC and APRA are going to have to behave differently, very differently.
Mm.
Just two quotes that Kenneth Hayne has in his report about ASIC's enforcement record and its approach to regulating misconduct.
We should come to that, exactly. But we should, and it's ridiculous that this is the first time I've thought about it in this conversation, we should spell out right there, there are two regulators here. There's ASIC, which is the corporate regulator, and there's APRA, which is the prudential regulator for the banks.
Yes.
Sorry, everyone, we should have done that from the get-go. Anyway, picking up where you were, Gareth.
So he said, this is Kenneth Hayne, the commissioner, he asked this question. When deciding what to do in response to misconduct, ASIC's starting point appears to have been, how can this be resolved by agreement? This cannot be the starting point for a conduct regulator. When contravening conduct comes to its attention, the regulator must always ask whether it can make a case that there has been a breach, and if it can, then ask why it would not be in the public interest to bring proceedings to penalise the breach. Laws are to be obeyed. Penalties are prescribed for failure to obey the law because society expects and requires obedience to the law.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we're heading.
Well, he's basically saying, isn't he, that that the regulators have got to gather the evidence and bring these cases to court,
yeah,
rather than sitting around having a kumbaya moment and, you know, having a gentleman's agreement for enforceable undertakings or whatever, right? Yeah. He's just basically saying take them to court, right?
And you know, when it comes to the politics of it, if the Morrison government and the Shorten Labor opposition are going to be smart about it, they're going to realise very quickly that they should be listening to this report, because there's a lot of anger out there in the community. People don't like being trampled over by big corporations. They want to see corporations treated justly before the law like individuals. Mm. And, you know, I think it's quite clear where this is at.
Yeah, and we'll get to the politics in a minute. Is there, though, do you think, Greg, when we think about this regulatory reset, how do you manage, though, the tensions between, which we were sort of getting at implicitly a minute ago, right, that the banks in a way trade on the requirement that they be well capitalised, that they be profitable, that they be literally pillars of the community, right, rather than, you know, well, the opposite, right? So there'll be this sort of prudential, call it a prudential imperative to be cashed up, reliable, opening their doors to the public, safe places to put your money, and a regulator having to come in, as Gareth puts it, with all guns blazing.
Yeah, I mean,
it's kind of slightly complicated.
I mean, the
right?
entire system operates on trust. You know, you give the money to the bank to keep because you trust that you can go and get it back at any time. And one of the interesting things for politicians, especially, and this is sort of both sides of politics, is during the GFC they very much talked up the banking system, the regulations, and all the way the banks operated as one of the reasons why our system didn't go into a free fall like America's and even in England. And yet, one of the things is the cost of that stability of, oh, these guys are really good and safe and everything, is we've let a lot of stuff go unobserved almost, or at least unmentioned, and now it's getting looked at. And I think it's, I mean, Haynes very much the onus is as much on the banks as anyone else. It's their culture that needs to change. And there, within that, there's aspects in terms of how remuneration is done, and, you know, to try and get rid of that profit motive from the decision-making process of people, where they're not so much concerned about offering you the best deal, they're concerned about offering the deal that will give them the best return.
Yeah.
So there will be aspects there that can be changed, but I think it's, I wonder if it's a, there is going to be obviously a bit of a shaking of confidence, but it's something that if it's done well and advocated well, it should be something that actually makes the system seem stronger. But I don't think, as Gareth was saying, if the political parties don't do anything, then I don't think that's going to help confidence either, especially. A lot of this goes to financial advice, goes to superannuation. This isn't just sort of, you know, they're charging me a higher rate of mortgage than they probably could. They've got a nice fat profit margin. It's actually they're dunning us. So, and I think it flows into other areas where people are starting to get a little bit shirty about how companies are treated compared to workers, when you see stories about workers being underpaid and, you know, barely getting a fine out of it, whereas we know, you know, if that worker was taking $5 an hour from the till rather than being charged, paid $5 an hour less than they should, you know, the situation would be different. So I think it's a case of the political parties aren't going, I think, to be able to hide under the, oh, well, we've got to, you know, the system is already there in place, we've just got to do it better or something. I think there might need to be a bit more there to actually keep the confidence. Because if you hold a Royal Commission and you don't really do anything out of it, that's, you know, we only have to think of the Royal Commission to institutional abuse. You know, if you just said, oh, well, we've
imagine
all got to, we've just got the police to be a bit more active. Well,
People wouldn't be satisfied. Mm. Now, well, we've landed neatly in politics. Well done, both of you. So let's just think about politics for a minute. I'll ask for, just given time, a yes or no answer, because this has been a matter of political debate. Should there be an extension of time? Should this inquiry go beyond next February, yes or no?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Greg?
Yes.
Okay. Just if you haven't followed this issue, this has been a matter of contention over the last couple of weeks. Labor says it should go beyond February because there's so much, well, basically so much malfeasance to get through. The government has dead-batted that, has said if Kenneth Hayne asks for an extension, we'll give him one. Thus far, he hasn't asked for one. Both of my experts think there should be one. Okay, so let's get into the grubby business of electoral politics and the looming election. Now, we expect... unless all hell breaks loose, touch wood now, everyone, that the election won't be this year, it'll be next year, and probably May-ish, right? Let's just all touch wood, please. Everyone, all together. So that's the sort of context, right, where the election will be playing out. What do we think about the lingering consequences of this? Obviously, there is a substantial report to be tabled and a substantive government and opposition response. But let's just think about the sort of how it plays in the political discussion. Obviously, the Turnbull government, and of which Scott Morrison was the treasurer, fiercely resisted this inquiry for a very, very long time. Do you think that they'll suffer any consequences?
Yeah. I think there'll be quite a few people who won't forget. But then there'll be quite a few people who do, because we're going to have summer break in between times when politics dies down, right?
Things wash through.
But the final report will come out in February when people have come back from holidays. So that will be a big bang. Labor's obviously going to be doing everything it can at every opportunity to remind people that Scott Morrison and his colleagues didn't want this Royal Commission. Morrison has been doing his best to articulate why he didn't want it, and he says he's learned from the experience and everything, but it hasn't been a very convincing articulation of his reasons why.
Greg, do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, his articulation is much the same as his articulating why he's now Prime Minister. It hasn't exactly been all that wonderful.
I walked past the open door and the job was suggested.
I didn't realise how much people were hurting or something. I mean, the ALP is certainly going to do their level best to make sure people don't forget, and there'll be plenty of grabs that they can use in quotes that they can use in adverts. The February deadline, or when the report comes out, is certainly a political reason to extend it, because if you extend it, then you don't really have to do anything, because you can just say, well, we'll wait until the election findings. If it comes out in February and we have an election in May, there's a fair bit of time to actually have to do something, and how much the Liberal Party wants to do.
Well, the whole process, you just close your eyes, really, like once the lobbying starts for all of that. Yeah. Now, obviously, the government has not covered itself in glory, right? We're in furious agreement about that in relation to this process. But you've both mentioned, I think correctly, that Labor thinks this is a campaignable issue and wants to keep it a campaignable issue. So, you know, we will see advertisements, I'm certain, of Scott Morrison resisting the inquiry and so on and so forth. Is there any risk for Labor, though, in overdoing the politics of this, do you think?
In what way?
Well, it's sort of, I think you can sort of, there's a fine line, I think, in terms of public consciousness between raising a legitimate issue and exploiting an issue for partisan purposes.
I think if all they're doing is saying how Morrison was against it, that I'm not sure how far that goes. It really...
It could get tired.
Yeah, I think what... their best bet is to fold it into their overarching argument of essentially inequality, and banks are the big business that are screwing workers, screwing you, screwing households, just like employers are screwing you, and therefore the government's really screwing you and we won't, and it feeds into that aspect, and how powerful that argument is will do a lot. Have a lot to do with how the actual economy's going, employment, whether wages actually do start to tick up and things. But I think if you're just focusing on Morrison said, you know, it's crass populism or it's a big whinge or something, you know, it's I think that it's kind of easy to head off if Morrison's able to say, oh, well, we're doing this and this. And
Because Labor, they've said that they'll create a task force that will implement the recommendations from the Royal Commission, and there's no reason why they wouldn't implement most of them, even though I haven't seen them. That's been their formulation of that argument. I imagine perhaps Morrison's government could head them off there by saying we'll do something similar.
Mm.
So we've learned from the past, and we'll also be implementing.
Yeah,
and that will kind of blunt their message in a way.
But and at the end of the day, it's a banking royal commission, and there's a reason why most people find financially illiterate and things, because they think banking, God,
boring.
Okay, and they just sort of shut out. It's not corruption of a political party or there's, you know, they're getting dodgy loans or something, you know, the Liberal Party's doing something bad, or, you know, it's not an ICAC kind of thing, in that the festering sores are not covering the Liberal Party in a way that, you know, the New South Wales Labor was really affected by ICAC.
Yeah, it's indirect.
You know, the political force of it, I think you could over-egg it a little bit there.
Well, potentially. Anyway, but look, how much content have we got to deal with seriously with this inquiry between now and when it reports? It's fantastic. Fantastic chat, guys. Really do appreciate it. Thank you, the listeners, as always, for tuning in. Thank you to the production team in Sydney, to Miles and to Hannah for sterling services, as always, to this podcast. Really do appreciate it. Don't forget to subscribe and share this podcast if you enjoy it. It really does help the longevity of the project, and we appreciate it, obviously, keeping the project visible. I'm actually going to be away for a week recharging my batteries in order to survive, hopefully, until the end of this year. So we will skip a week, but we will be back the following week. Until then, be well.